So Aegean also has, so risk is your kind of, your equivalent of hit points, but you can voluntarily take it. So you can like gain a point of risk to gain a success on something. So if you really, really want to succeed and you're out of all other options, you can just say, right, I'm taking a point of risk and I'm doing it. So there's already that mechanic for managing your risk yourself, because you want to keep it low, but actually it's also a very useful resource.
Welcome to Tabletop Talk, a podcast where I talk to creatives in tabletop gaming about more than what they make. I focus on how and why they create. You found the right podcast if you enjoy game design and learning about the creative process. In this interview, I talk with Stu Gaw, the creator of Aegean. We talk about the inspirations behind his game, The Gaslight Club, how Aegean didn't start as a game about mythic Greece. And we wrap it up by talking about retro games he's been tracking down and buying on eBay. Okay, sit back, relax, and enjoy my time with Stu.
This is Guy Milner. When I'm not running one-shot games at conventions, you'll find me listening to Tabletop Talk.
Howdy, friends. Craig here. Today, I'm chatting with writer, developer, and publisher Stu Gaw. Stu is the creator behind the RPGs Aegean and The Gaslight Club, and is the publisher of Wild, that was created by a friend of the show, David Chapman. Now, Stu Gaw is also a musician and programmer, and when not buried beneath a mountain of programming code or torturing guitars, he can be found creating strange new lands and conjuring dreams from nothing. He regularly promises himself that he will finish the next novel and album. Welcome to the third floor, Stu.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm absolutely wonderful. Now, I'm forced by contract to ask you the question you get asked every time you come on a podcast, which is, you know, where did you get started? But I'm going to phrase it a little bit differently. There was a day where you knew nothing about tabletop role playing. You knew nothing about grabbing dice and a sheet of paper and pretending to be other people. And it was put in front of you for the very first time. Can you take me back there?
Right. Yeah. So I think my first like tangential kind of introduction was Fighting Fantasy game books. So I kind of I read a few of those, and I was about 9 or 10, and we'd just moved from a like tiny little village to Norwich, which is a small city, but it seemed quite big at the time. So and there was a lot of upheaval. Like my mum had remarried, and I gained siblings and all sorts. So I was in a new school with a hell of a lot going on. And I like loved
it. Good Lord, that's a lot of change all at once.
Yeah, it was it was a lot. So yeah, new school, bet. Fighting Fantasy game books were like what kept me going at the time. Loved them. And I like hadn't been at the school long, hadn't really made any friends, but someone saw me reading them and said, oh yeah, I've got that one. I've just finished that one. That's really good. And that was Jake, who I'm still friends with to this day. And
get out of here.
Yeah, seriously.
How cool is that?
Yeah, we went for a drink not that long ago. And he kind of, there was him and another guy who I actually don't remember so well. And we got as far as characters for Tunnels and Trolls.
Nice.
But we never played it. With that kind of, you know, childhood, school stuff, it kind of, like friendships change and stuff. But Jake, we ended up playing the D&D Red Box, and that's kind of where we got started. So it's like me, him, and a few other people. And yeah, it was good fun. And it kind of grew from that, really.
So Stu, you know, obviously as a kid, we don't really know why we like things. We just kind of do and we do them. But as adults, when we look back, I mean, we're talking about you, you know, with the books and then with the Red Box, you ended up making, you know, a big part of your adult life around this hobby. So looking back and when you first started kind of getting your tiny little head around this, what is it you think got its hooks into you?
It's probably a mix of things. I think it's that the imagination is a big part. You can just go wild. Like coming up with all sorts of characters and stories and you share them as well. You know, it's not like writing where you sit on your own and kind of churn this thing out until it's done. It's very much, you can have the nugget of an idea, but it doesn't grow into anything until you're with your friends and doing stuff. And I kind of, I'm not quite a maths geek, but I kind of lean a little that way. And I kind of like the, like, what does this dice roll mean? And what do these stats mean in combination? And yeah, that kind of fascinates me. So I think that's why I ended up designing games. Because even like back then at school, we played a whole load of stuff. But we also, we kind of messed around with our own ideas for what we wanted as well. So it even started back then.
That's cool. So you've got really kind of both aspects of the hobby kind of tickled you a little bit, which is the mechanics and the crunch, you know, and understanding how the maths work combined with the imaginative piece. So when you start playing and at some point, you know, I'm sure you're creating at the table. That's what we do when we all play. But at some point you got the desire to create beyond your table, right? To start creating for others. Do you have a sense of when that is and where that desire came from?
So, I mean, we messed around with rule systems when I was at school, but that never really kind of took it any further than that. But it was really, so I kind of left the hobby as I got older. I think, yeah, I mean, that's common, isn't it? It's a sort of thing that happens. And I kind of got back into it in my mid-30s. And we've been playing a lot, and I was sort of, it's dissatisfaction with things is kind of a big motivator for me. So,
fair.
Yeah. So I was sort of playing quite a few different games, and they're all good, and they're all really, they're like really fun and doing the things in different ways. And there's always like a little thing which just kind of like doesn't work for me. And it's like, well, I can try and like, what would I do differently? Like, you know, it's not enough to say, oh, this is annoying or it doesn't work. It's like, you know, if it's broken, you try and fix it, right? And GMs do that all the time. You know, you often find that rules as written and rules as played are very, very different. And I kind of expanded on that and started looking at a few different games that I kind of quite liked but were quite different. And I wanted to know, you know, how could I bring some of these interesting things from this game into this other game? And that's when I sort of started messing around with what eventually became Aegean, but took a long while to get there. And from there I was sort of thinking, well, some of these games are big and expensive and a lot of effort goes into them, but like the core of what you do with it is maybe like 10 pages.
Right.
It's not that big. And some of these things are, you know, actually people are putting effort and time and money into getting the game out. And it feels like they've overlooked a lot of stuff and they haven't really play tested a lot of these things. So like, why can they do that? And why can't I? So maybe I can like push what I'm messing around with at the moment and pushing it into something that finished that could be usable by other people. That was then like a ton of work, that finished bit. That one word is huge.
There's a lot behind that one phrase, isn't there? And that's really a blocker for a lot of people, right? I think there's a lot of people that you know, want to create and want to publish and put stuff out there, but it's the finishing that tends to be what blocks it.
Yeah, definitely. And I now, like, when I was thinking all of that, like 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, I was obviously very, very deluded in what, you know, these finished books were like and why they might have mistakes in them. Because now I know. Now I've got a Aegean sitting there. It's 300 pages and I know of at least 2 typos and I'm not reading it. It's going to be years before I reread it because who knows what else is in there.
Oh, God, Stu, that's so funny because I laugh at and you know, I'm not laughing at them, but I laugh at the phrase, like you'll see people going, did they even play test this or how did they miss this? And I'm like, tell me you've never published something without telling me you've never published it. Like it's just the reality of that. So the easy question to answer, Stu, would be, when did you first become a professional game designer? Right. That's easy. The first time that you put something out and you got paid for it. My question is a little bit different. When did you first feel like a professional game designer? When did that feeling go like, oh my God, like I am a game designer?
I'm not sure. It's probably only this year. It's
really
like, yeah. So Aegean was, so initially the Gaslight Club was a Kickstarter and that was relatively successful. Aegean as a Kickstarter was very, very, like much more successful. I was very pleased with that. But it was only this year, though, so it's sort of June, July, when it started getting delivered, so that the actual physical book started appearing in people's hands, and it was seeing like photos on Twitter or Facebook or whatever of people with the book. That's, I think that's when it actually felt like, oh yeah, I'm doing this now. That's it's happening.
Can you help? Because I am not a game publisher nor a game designer, and don't really want to be. Luckily, there's enough people like used to out there that make enough games that I don't have to worry about. Like everything I need is out there. But I'm always curious what learning or trying to understand the feeling of letting your baby go. Right. So you see pictures of people, you know, hey, I got my Aegean, and you know, it will obviously you hope that they're going to end up playing that game. But you're not going to be there, Stu, right? Like everything, your only presence is printed in those words. And I've always tried to understand, what is that like to release something out in the world and know that others are going to take it and take your instrument and play it themselves?
It's a bit weird, but it's quite satisfying as well.
How so?
Because it's satisfying because, well, it's a lot of work that's gone into it. And, and with a Kickstarter, you, you know, you get a lot of people going, well, like, where is this? Because it was delayed. You know, there were things happened, and it was about a year later than I'd had intended to have it released. So there is a kind of, you know, there's that during that period, there's a lot of people going, well, where is it? Where's my book? Maybe I should change my pledge. So that all can be a bit kind of negative. So actually seeing people there and coming back to me and saying, oh yeah, I'm running this for my daughter, and we're having a great time. You know, that's really, really satisfying.
I mean,
they could be playing a completely different game. The nature of role-playing games is what happens at the table can be very, very different to what is in the book. Yep. But they're taking something which I've created, and they're taking my ideas, and they're making use of them. And that's just like the, I mean, that's a joyful kind of feeling, right? That's what I intend. That's what I set out to do, and it's working. But it's a bit weird because I have no idea how they're playing. Like, there aren't any actual plays or anything. So, all I assume it all runs exactly the way that I would run it, but obviously it's not the case. So it's a bit sort of like, I hope I got that across right. I hope that, you know, I hope that makes sense. And I hope that's kind of informed their gaming and given them lots of ideas, but you can't really know unless you're sitting in on every single game. So it's a bit of both, but it's mostly a kind of satisfying feeling just to know that people are playing it.
Now, we talked about in the intro how you published Wild, and we've had David on the show. So people listening, hopefully you've listened to that episode with David, but this again is another realm where, you know, you've differentiated yourself, right? There's a lot of people that publish games, a lot of people put out games. Design games and put out games, but you publish games that you didn't make. When did that happen? When did you start moving over into that aspect of the industry and hobby?
So that was Gaslight Club had come out. That was a Kickstarter. Aegean was still kind of, it was getting there, but it was still had a lot to do. And Dave he'd been working on Wild for quite some time. And I kind of figured, you know, he'd done a lot of work. We'd done some playtesting as well. So we had actually done a few online sessions, like going through the mechanics and the character creation, which some of that got, then obviously there was feedback from the playtest and it got kind of changed a little and improved, but he was still working on it. And I kind of felt like he needed a bit of a push just to do that finishing thing, because it is a big amount of work. So we kind of talked about it and talked about what it would entail. Like, do we need to, how professional do we need to make it? Do we need to do contracts and things like that? Do we need to, is just an email of what we're agreeing, is that enough?
Right.
And then we kind of moved it on from there. And then we talked about what the game needed, what we could do as a kind of first, like a first push for it. And from there, we got the Kickstarter. And then I got to kind of message him every week going, have you written it yet? Have you written it yet? it wasn't quite that bad, but no. But yeah, so it kind of came out of seeing a friend who had got so far with it, but hadn't got that finish and wasn't really keen on doing the Kickstarter and doing that, the management of that. And having just done it, I kind of felt like while it's not, it's a mixed experience. You know, it's, mm-hmm. it's enjoyable getting it done and getting like people like going, wow, this seems really cool. And I want to give you my money I want to find out how this is going to turn out. But it is also a bit stressful in that, Wild ended up like this room was just filled with boxes. I mean, it's a bit of a mess now, but it was filled with boxes and packing tape and bubble wrap. Oh. And you know, that was, it's probably about 2 months of me just packaging things up. So there's a lot of logistics stuff, which definitely puts people off. And so we talked about all that and I felt like I could do that bit for him and we did. That's kind of how it came out and it worked.
So what you're describing, Stu, for a lot of people listening is a nightmare. But for you, obviously it's something that you have found satisfaction in. Why is that? Why is this something that, having a packing tape and boxing and pushing a creator to finish, why is that something that you actually enjoy?
I think I don't enjoy that bit. But I enjoy the end bit, you know, I enjoy the actual, they've now get to see that book in their hands that they otherwise wouldn't have done. So that bit's enjoyable. And the, all of the mess and the packing tape and the logistics it's not a night. Well, I mean, I don't know. You just kind of work through it. It's just a chore that needs to be done to get to this end point.
Well, and it tells us how significant the end point is for you because you go through the trudge of the rest of it, right?
Yeah. And it is, I mean, it, like I've known Dave for like about 30 years, I think. Yeah, no, it's about that. So like he seeing him get to see this thing that he created finished is another like satisfying, joyful experience for me. So that's good.
So as you were helping him with Wild, and you're in the role of the publisher, right? Which is different than Dave's role, which was David was the creator and the designer. Is it hard for you to keep your designer mouth shut and let him do his job? Or do you find yourself just not being able to help yourself and you end up getting a little bit of design work in there?
I made suggestions. But okay. I was very light touch. And actually, I don't think any of my, I don't know. If any suggestions I made were up to Dave, whether they went in or not. And I'm actually not sure that any of them did, to be honest.
Right.
Because I can see why it's easy to think that it would be hard to sort of stay away from that. But actually, I know all of the stuff that I don't know all of it, but I know the stuff that I'm going to make, right? I mean, right. I don't know it. But it's not really going to surprise me. Whereas seeing what Dave comes up with is a surprise. So letting him just go and run with it was kind of fine. And I was there for editing, and which I'm not always great at, and and feedback and things like that. But mostly it was just, I just left him to it. And what he made is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it helps also to have a partner like David, who's very good at what he does too. Right. So guys, the Insider Insight series allows me to sit down with designers, developers, artists, writers, and creators and learn how they approach their work. I try to understand their process, the inspiration and methods for crafting their creations. We're going to do that with Stu. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about the Gaslight Club. We'll be right back.
Hey everyone, this is Zoe, co-host of the Maniculum podcast, here to tell you about our new Kickstarter project, launching June 1st of this year. The Marginal Worlds Kickstarter is a deck of 50 easy-to-play magic items pulled directly from medieval manuscripts that you can play in any TTRPG. So if you're looking to dazzle your players with magic items once hidden for centuries in ancient tomes, sign up on Kickstarter or themaniculumpodcast.com to check out sample cards, playtest them yourself, and bring the magic to your table on June 1st.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
So Stu, it's funny, as you know, I start poking around and I think it was Aegean was the first time you got on my radar. So, you know, when David and I connected us is when I started to dig into the Gaslight Club. And it is rare that I come across an RPG setting that I don't think I've ever seen anything like it before. And this is the case with it. So I'm going to read the blurb off the website about what the Gaslight Club is to give the listeners some context, but I've got lots of questions. All right. So the Gaslight Club is a role-playing game set in an advanced theme park with the veneer of the early 20th century. The players take on the roles of the theme park's hosts as they attempt to uncover the true nature of the world around them. It's inspired by Mutant Year Zero, Genesis, and Blades in the Dark. Three of my favorite things, by the way. So there was a time where nothing close to Gaslight Club existed, right? So imagine that I take my 9-year-old daughter to the Stugoff Museum, and we're going to go to the section of the museum that's the Gaslight Club, and we go to the first exhibit, which shows the acorn when it fell from the tree that ended up growing into the Gaslight Club. Can we go back there? Where do you think the Gaslight Club was first born?
So, I mean, it's Westworld. It's I can't even deny that. It's easy to spot. But I really enjoyed the new TV. Well, it's not new anymore, is it? The reimagining of the original movie as a TV show. That was great. And with a lot of things, like a lot of the time when I'm watching something, I'm thinking, how would I run this? You know, like, how would I run this as an adventure? And it kind of grew out of that, but it became, you know, I was sort of thinking about, well, I would run it in Blade. Maybe I'd run it in Blade in the Dark and Genesis and all the games you listed, which I've just found in my original notes where originally it was going to be Genesis more than anything else. Yeah. Yeah.
And just real quick on that, Stu, why? What was it about Genesis that made it potentially the system to use?
I think it's the dice mechanic that you've got three axes of results. It's not just success, failure. You've got all of those other bits which you could kind of, you know, that impact the story, like really move things along. And that's kind of what I was thinking of. But a lot of the, like when I'm sort of generally thinking about these sorts of things, like, well, how would I run this? What system would I run it in? I normally settle on something. Mm-hmm. And with the Gaslight Club, I didn't. I kind of, that Genesis didn't quite work for me. Blades in the Dark, I felt I'd need to change too much with the crew that wouldn't be applicable, and I wasn't sure that would quite work. And in the end, I settled on something which is pretty much Year Zero engine with a few of the influences from Blades and from Genesis.
So if I flip through the Gaslight Club today, where would I see those fingerprints? So where would I say, oh, look at, there's a little bit of Genesis here, or go, ooh, look at John Harper's influences here. Where would I find that if I flip through the book?
Okay, so it's a D6 dice pool system, which is clearly, very clear Year Zero.
Right.
But the stress mechanic and is very much Blade in the Dark. I'm actually not sure where, if Genesis left anything, because it is... its characteristics, skills, and talents, which is Genesis, but is also Year Zero. So they're very similar in that kind of regard.
Right.
But yeah, there's some Blades definitely in the stress system.
Were you able to kind of dabble in that non-binary results, right? That we talked about, the multiple axes that you see in Genesis. Do we see that in the Gaslight Club? Is everything success, fail?
It's the Year Zero success fail, but you can push a role if you actually really need to succeed or need more successes. That kind of multiple axis thing didn't really make it into it.
So if I'm hearing this correctly, Stu, we started off with the inspiration and the beginnings of the setting. You then search for some mechanics. You end up picking up some pieces, putting together essentially your own system, but with influences. At what point do they start informing each other? So were there moments during design where the mechanics change the setting or the setting push the mechanics?
It's normally the setting I find pushes the mechanics. Okay. It's like, I want to represent how this would work. Like a big thing being, well, your character is going to realize that something's not right with the world. That it's not their life they're living. It is a theme park. So there needs to be something which triggers that. So That's where the stress system comes in. So you gain too much stress, you go over your resolve threshold, and suddenly you kind of you break down. Your programming can't cope with this anymore, and you gain a trauma, which is a negative effect on one of your skills, but you also gain a new talent, and you gain access to a whole set of new talents as well. So you gain the I can't remember what it's called. It's Awakened, I think. And it immediately lets you see the difference. You don't know what the difference is, and you don't know why you can see it, but you can see the people who are like you and the people who are walking around who aren't like you. And suddenly, well, that's a hint that something else is going on. And you get all of these other talents that can do all sorts of funky things as well.
So in your mind, because and help me out if I'm wrong here, Stu, but in your mind, it sounds like, you know, as a player, my character and that I'm inhabiting is eventually going to start peeling the onion, right? Is slowly going to start realizing what the hell is going on. Do you see the Gaslight Club as a game that you play and there's an end point to it? Or is it, you know, something that you can go beyond that? Like I'm trying to get a sense of, because it doesn't sound like a dungeon crawl D&D, right? Where I can just play forever because there's always another dungeon, because it sounds like there's a series of revelations that happen. Am I making sense?
Yeah. I think it's very much that. Like when I was sort of playtesting it and before I even thought about doing a Kickstarter with it, I was running with the group, and it had a definite conclusion. There was a definite point that it doesn't make sense to play beyond. And it's that realization. Once you really realize what is going on, you either have to do something like catastrophic about it or you get like permanently ended, which is the sad ending of it. So I think it does have a conclusion. And a friend of mine, actually, after the Kickstarter, he GM'd it for me and the group, and he put his own little twist on what the actual setting was. So that was quite good fun. So I got to experience that again. But still, it had a finite end. It still had once you've gone through these revelations, you've got to a point where you can't, like, your character can't continue as they are. So, yeah.
So if I were to break into your house and find all of the materials that you put together for playtesters and then put my copy of Gaslight Club next to that, I'd like to get a sense of what happened. So from the process of playtesting, how did the game change?
So I think initially it became a lot more codified. I don't think I had some ideas for archetypes, but they weren't really quite as strong as they became in the final book. And a lot of that is to do with the space. Like, I wanted it to be 40 odd pages and nothing more, which kind of limits you to what you can actually do.
Right.
But I kind of like that limit as well, just because it really makes you kind of refine what you're doing and what you're putting out there. So initially I had a lot of talents, which were kind of more a instruction on how you would make a talent rather than the actual talent itself. And the same with equipment. There was a lot of, well, you can get these bonuses if it costs this much money. And a lot of that just didn't really, you know, was too much to fit in. So a lot of that got streamlined. But a lot of, like, once I'd set on it being a venue for comedy and a venue for music in the 20s, once that was done, that setting didn't really change. That was very, very early on, very fixed. But mechanically, it was more refinement more than anything.
Gotcha.
Yes, like, you know, 80 pages of notes, which became a 40-page book almost.
And we touched on it a little bit, but I want to talk about it a little bit more because, you know, the obvious end-to-end process, there's changes, right? There's the initial concept, a couple runs that you make before you show it to anybody, you show it to some people, they give you some feedback. It sounds, what I'd like to learn is, I mean, we've talked about what changed, right? But what didn't change? So when you go back and look at the beginning and where you ended up with Gaslight Club, what was just steady state through the whole thing? What never changed?
I mean, it changed a little bit, but the concept of you're going to get so much stress that, or so much injury or stress or effect is going to break you in some way and give you these advantages. That was cool, like right from the beginning. The way that mechanic works has kind of adjusted a little bit, but not by much. I think more the advantages that you get are what changed, not the actual breaking point itself.
So conceptually, it stayed the same. There may have been some tweaks to how it played, but the idea was there from the beginning.
Yeah, it's absolutely consistent. It's like in my very first bit of notes, it's this is what's going to happen, and then you're going to get this. But what you get kind of changed a bit.
When it gets out to the world, both during playtest and after publishing, it's gone. And like we've kind of talked about earlier, you know, Stu's no longer there. But you're getting feedback, right? So people are coming back, or you're coming across reviews and things like that. Is there anything that surprised you, anything that you saw, read, or heard about the game that you didn't anticipate, and good or bad? But unexpected, right?
Unexpected. I think some people were put off by the name, actually, just because the whole concept of gaslighting obviously is not a great thing. And I kind of, I mean, you can run it as a, you don't tell your players what's going to happen. But I kind of put in the book that, you know, you need to make sure you're with a group that you know. You can't just spring this on people. So I had that, but like that feedback was a bit more than I was expecting. I wasn't really expecting it to, the name itself, to just put people off.
Well, and I think to build off of what you just said, Stu, it tells me that safety tools and that session zero discussion is important, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
For that exact reason.
Yeah.
So, guys, we're going to take another break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about the bigger game. We're going to talk about Aegean. We'll be right back. Are you enjoying our long-form interviews with creatives on this podcast? Maybe you're craving deeper discussions about our guests or some of the RPG plays on our Twitch and YouTube channel. Well, I've got an opportunity for you. You see, Third Floor Wars now has a Patreon-only Discord server. You can join a vibrant community of like-minded enthusiasts diving deep into every episode of our RPG plays and podcast. Connect with fans, engage in spirited discussions, and unlock the behind-the-scenes insights. For just $1 a month, access a world of tabletop gaming goodness. Connect with passionate gamers who share your love for the tabletop podcast and everything produced on the Third Floor. As a Patreon supporter, you also enjoy ad-free episodes of this podcast. You can immerse yourselves in captivating stories and fascinating interviews without interruptions, taking your listening experience to a whole new level. By joining the Third Floor Wars Patreon community, you not only gain exclusive access to the Patreon-only Discord server, but you also support the growth of my podcast and channels. Your contributions enable me to continue creating high-quality content that entertains, educates, and upskills tabletop enthusiasts like yourself. Maybe don't wait. Join the Third Floor Wars Patreon today and unlock a world of camaraderie, discussions, and knowledge. Visit patreon.com/thirdfloorwars or check the link in the show notes and come join our community. The Third Floor Wars Patreon-only Discord server awaits you. I and the other patrons can't wait to welcome you with open arms and a fistful of dice. So this game, we've learned as we've talked, was your baby for a long time. So even though it came out after Gaslight Club, it sounds like the beginnings of it were earlier. So again, I'm going to read the blurb from the description so that people can understand what we're talking about. But again, I've got lots of questions. So Aegean is a tabletop role-playing game about a group of mythic heroes building a new free city on the shores of the Aegean Sea. There are neighboring cities to trade or war with, monsters to kill and gods to appease, deceptions, negotiations, and bloody skirmishes. The world of Aegean is an ancient Greece that never existed, a mix of mythology and classical history. The gods visit the earth and converse with mortals, granting gifts of magic and life to some and fear and terror to others. fearsome monsters roam the lands and seas, making every journey an adventure. Strange creatures, some mortal, others half divine, can be found in the wilderness. These centaurs, nymphs, and tritons teach, harass, or ignore humans as their whim takes them. So when we talk about, like, this has been something that's been in your brain and rattling around for a long time, what was it? So would we go back to this thing that just was begging you to make? What was it in its earliest form?
So originally it wasn't Greek myth based. It was just a kind of generic fantasy. But there were a few things which are still there, which I kind of wanted to do in a fantasy game. I think the big one is I wanted more than just your heroes wandering off. You could be homeless vagabonds. It doesn't matter. I wanted to have that kind of central location as a focus. So that idea made it all the way through to the end. So you're in Aegean, your polis, your kind of city state is your home, and you can get involved in the politics. You don't have to, you can completely ignore it, obviously. But it's there, so you can get elected to the local council. You can raise statues to your own glory if that's what you want to spend the funds on. You know, actually, there's a mechanic for diverting funds as well into your own coffers. Yeah. But that core bit of more than just, like, I wanted a kind of anchor point into the world. So your home city and your involvement in its growth and development was the key thing that I really wanted.
And why is that, Stu? So why did you feel like that was needed in the role-playing world, right? So what made you think this addition was significant for you?
So I think at the time, again, Blade in the Dark was a big influence, and I was playing Pendragon as well.
Ooh,
and
nice.
Pendragon is, you know, lovely system, but it becomes it's a bookkeeping system. Like, it's the Excel spreadsheet of role-playing games.
You it's really a lot. Do need. Yep.
Yeah, it is a lot. And I wanted to kind of simplify that. And I really liked how Blade had your crew as a kind of touchstone, as your kind of anchor point. So I kind of wanted to do that. And obviously with Blade, it's much more, it's much simpler to do. Yep. It's just simpler to manage. It ticks on the character sheet. So I kind of wanted to take that approach and kind of apply it to Pendragon. And that's kind of where it sort of started, as a kind of generic fantasy sort of thing. But that seemed, it just actually, I mean, I love fantasy books and I love fantasy role-playing games, obviously. But it didn't seem to be enough just as a fantasy setting. So then I was just kind of thinking about, like, what isn't that? What should be out there but isn't? And a kind of Greek mythology RPG seemed perfect, because there really wasn't anything. I mean, there are a few kind of D&D settings and things now, but
it's not Aegon, the same as what we're talking about, though.
No, not at all. Aegon has come along, but even that is a very different take on Greek mythology. So I had this anchor point I wanted. I wanted the home, and I was then sort of thinking, well, Greece could, like, Greek mythology could really, really work. And it would work with that anchor point as well, because your city state is a major influence for you.
So, you know, coming up with the setting, both thematically as well as geographically, obviously solved a lot of problems for you, right? It answered some questions, the things that were bugging you. What challenges did it bring, though? What once you made that decision, like, this is where I'm going to put this game, this is what this game is going to be, I'm sure it created new challenges that didn't exist before you made that choice. And I'd like to know what those are.
Yeah. So it added a lot of things I wouldn't have otherwise considered. Like, there's a hubris mechanic,
which, very cool.
Yeah. Which is, you know, the bad things, or the not necessarily bad, the frowned upon things, or the things that the gods wouldn't approve of. I mean, that wouldn't have been there without the setting. That's just, yeah, the setting brought that. And once I decided on the setting and rewatched, you know, Jason and the Argonauts and Attack of the Titans and things like that, I kind of wanted to bring the gods into it much more. Like, they're not just, I mean, you can play it straight and ignore them if you want, but mechanically I wanted to bring the gods into it and make them present. So that brought in things like favor and disfavor roles. You know, if Artemis doesn't like you, then your archery is going to suffer for it. Cool. So it really kind of, it like it made it a better game because I suddenly had all of these things I wanted to incorporate into it just from the setting. And to make them worth incorporating, you have to have a mechanical basis for it. Otherwise, it could be anything. It's just narrative and you could make it up or change it as you see fit. But if there's a mechanical kind of hook into it, then it's important.
You know, when we deal with a world like this, Stu, where, you know, gods are real, they're present and they're involved in human affairs, I would imagine there's a danger that our players could feel inconsequential, right? Because they're not gods, right? They're not, you know, that powerful. How do you handle that in the game? How do we make sure that our players feel like their characters matter and have influence on the world in a world with gods who are meddling in the world? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So again, that's a mechanical thing. The favor and disfavor, it only affects a few skills or skills that are relevant to that deity. And it's once per session. So it's not it's not every time you draw your bow, you are going to miss. It's the GM looking at you and going, don't you have a disfavor with Artemis? Don't you? Yeah. And getting you to reroll all of the good stuff. It's a mechanical tie-in. So it's very thematic, but it just affects you in this one little way. And obviously with hubris, that can bring in curses and things, but that, again, it's all mechanically tied in. So you've got a way that if you can see that your hubris is greater than your glory, well, you're going to be cursed. So you can push to reduce your hubris during downtime and things like that. Proper offerings to the gods will reduce it and appease that. So yeah, making sure there's a mechanical focus for it and it's not an overpowering one kind of keeps the narrative from being overpowering as well.
Now, Stu, as you're playing it, as you're running it, as you're seeing it being played, through that, do you remember when you really felt like you'd got it, where you really had captured what you were trying to capture at the very beginning? Do you remember that moment where you're like, I think I got it?
I'm not sure.
Or maybe you felt that way the whole time, Stu. I don't know, yeah. Right?
I don't know. It is definitely a progression because there were definitely points where it didn't quite feel right. It wasn't that mechanical aspect of the gods or the setting weren't involved, but it was very much a gradual kind of process. I don't think there was one defining moment where I went, right, that's it. It was, yeah, it's like this is definitely, this mechanic has definitely helped, or this changing of the skills around has definitely helped. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was one kind of defining hallelujah kind of moment.
And let me sidestep just a bit, because I think this question's related. One of the things I keep hearing, Stu, when I talk to creators as they're making these games, is I often hear that there was something that was bugging them the whole time, right? That this goblin that they just could not get rid of until what ends up being the very end, when they add something or take something out and it all collapses and collects and clicks. Did that happen with this game? Was there something towards the end that you did, again, added or removed or changed, that made, finally, now it's clicking?
It was wounds.
Oh, how so?
So the original quick start I put out, it just had wound boxes. So every time you took a wound, you got a different penalty. You filled in a box, you got a -1 or a -2. That went, and now it's a random table instead. Which just changed what happens. You know, it makes it, rather than it being, I've got a -1 box, so I'm happy to take that wound. I don't need to adjust what I'm doing. Now it's a random thing and it's D10 plus all of your existing wounds. So that table goes quite high, you know, it goes up to about 16, but you want to roll low on that. So if you've already got a lot of wounds, maybe you don't want to maybe you want to do something else rather than just fight this person, or you want to take a defensive approach or something. So yeah, that was a big change. And that's when it felt like the game was kind of finished. I'm not sure if it ever feels 100% finished, right, but finished. Yeah.
Yeah. And that sounds really neat to me, Stu, because that adds a level of tension to all of the decisions, right? So if wounds are just a resource, which in many games it is, right? And you say, yeah, I can handle that. I can take, you know, I can take 3 wounds and I'll be okay. Whereas if we have a little bit more of, say, like a year zero type thing, because we see that type of stuff in year zero with the critical injuries, right? Or I think about Dungeon Crawl Classics also has the you never quite know what's going to happen. That adds a whole level of tension.
So Aegean also has, so risk is your kind of, your equivalent of hit points, but you can voluntarily take it. So you can like gain a point of risk to gain a success on something. So if you really, really want to succeed and you're out of all other options, you can just say, right, I'm taking a point of risk and I'm doing it. So there's already that mechanic for managing your risk yourself, because you want to keep it low, but actually it's also a very useful resource. So then to have that and wounds also be a resource that you can just fiddle around with, it was very unsatisfying. I mean, it was okay, but it was just not the same as, well, now I've got a risk. I'm actually risking something now. I'm risking the dice roll.
So I'm going to give you a hypothetical. So Stu, you and I are walking to lunch, and somebody just randomly on the street comes up and go, are you Stu Goff? And you're like, yeah, that's who I am. And you're the guy that made Aegean, right? And you're like, yeah, that's me. What's the next thing that person could say to you that would make you feel really good about the game?
I mean, I loved it. I played it with my group. My group loves this game. We've been playing this for, 10 sessions now, and we're looking forward to whatever next book you're coming out with. I think that would do it for me. Yeah.
So, all right. So I'm going to give you the hypothetical follow-up that you give this person. You say, well, why are you guys enjoying it so much? What could they say that would just make you feel really good as you and I went to grab a beer?
I really like how it all fits together. Mm. I like how this leads into this other thing. Like your character choices lead into the city development. I think that would please me. Like knowing that they kind of got that, because it is quite a big chunk of the game, and it is also it's implicit in the system that your character affects your city, and your city's growth affects your character, but it's not ever stated anywhere that that's what you need to do. So if they said that, then that's like you really got this, you really understood what I was going for.
That's cool.
That would be pleasing.
And that sounds to me like, and this is something that I love in some games. There are times when I'll play a game and the feedback that I'll put out there into the world is, you can't just read this game. You have to play this game to really experience it. It sounds like this might be the case here, right? That I could read from cover to cover Aegean, but there's things that I'll uncover and understand about it only by playing it. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Like the basics are basic, it's a dice pool system, it's stat plus skill, it's all quite straightforward, but it's only when you get to kind of playing and you're going, right, actually, I need to be able to succeed on this. Oh, well, I've got options for succeeding. I've got ways that I can do that. And things like, now we're doing a downtime phase. We're doing a like relaxing and healing and all the rest. Well, it's only then that you can clear your wounds properly. Right. So it's things like that, which you can kind of read about, but until your character is there going, I've got six wounds. They've had some first aid, but I'm still like, I'm in danger here. We need to find somewhere to rest. It's not until you play it that you kind of really get that and really kind of feel that you need to do this, rather than it just being a, well, that's quite nice.
Yeah. That's awesome. So, Stu, one of the things that I have found very interesting, and this is a segment of the show that just kind of pushed itself into it, and now I do it with every interview, because I find it interesting. You are making things, but you're also consuming things. And we talked a little bit about you watching Westworld, right, and how that became something else. I would like to know, is there anything out there recently that you have watched or read or played that just got its hooks into you the way you hope stuff you make gets into others? Is there something that just has taken up your headspace recently?
Gaming wise, I've been doing a bit of a retro thing this year. So I've been scouring eBay for things that I enjoyed playing as a kid, but I haven't really kind of looked at since. So TMNT, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, was one of those things. And I got a secondhand copy of like second edition off of eBay. And it's kind of like the good bits are exactly as I remember it, like the character generation with the bio E points, and one person's rolled up a lab rat and someone else has rolled up a ninja. And there's a real kind of like charm to that. And I picked up some of the supplements as well. So I got those, get nutty.
Those supplements, absolutely.
They're wonderful. They're like the mutants down under with the, well, you could be a kind of Aboriginal shaman, or you could be kind of a blimp mechanic, or you could be a ninja still. You know, it really, yeah, it's very charming the way it kind of all plays into that. The mechanics are, I found to be a bit of a mess, but that was a...
Yeah.
And we've
progressed beyond that, right? We have learned to be better than it was mechanically, but... I have argued, and I'd be curious to know if you agree with this, that I think, you know, that when people talk about games that changed things, you know, there's obviously Dungeons and Dragons is talked about, Apocalypse World is talked about as, you know, things that changed the game. I've always felt like the two secret games that I think had a bigger influence than people may not initially recognize. I think Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is one of them that really kind of changed how we made games. The other one I think is Ghostbusters. I think Ghostbusters was another game that really changed things.
There's a lot in that, like Ghostbusters. Yeah, I mean, it was a fun game to read. It wasn't just like amongst all of my other going back at retro gaming. I looked at Bushido, and that was I can't believe I played that as a kid, like as a 12-year-old, because it's such a dry and. Yeah, just uninspiring kind of text to read through. But like Ghostbusters is fascinating. That's hilarious. It's really like it feels like an extension of the movie. It's absolutely great. Yeah, and mechanically, that was. I mean, that's probably the most modern 80s game there is. I mean, so the ghost on the dice had an effect. Even your stats were quite concise. Everything was, absolutely wonderful. And it was like little cards, wasn't it? Everything fitted onto.
It's not uncommon for me to read a new quote unquote new game and go, there's Ghostbusters right there. And the creator may not even realize it because it's so far removed at this point. It's amazing. How about non-gaming? Is there any media out there that has really, I mean, I know you're a musician. Is there any music out there that you've discovered recently that you have just got like can't stop listening to or can't stop watching?
So music wise, I mean, I'm at the moment I'm running Aegean, but with a kind of Norse kind of, which was probably going to be the next game, to be honest. With a kind of Norse setting. So it kind of matches quite well. And I've been listening to a lot of like Tyr and Korpiklaani and Amorphis, who are very much a sort of, battle metal type thing. Very, very Norse or Scandinavian myth kind of influence. Yep. So that musically that's what I've been going for at the moment. TV wise, actually completely different take, Travelers, on Netflix, which is a kind of, people have come back from the future, into the present to fix mistakes. It's kind of Terminator.
I've not watched it.
Right. It's on Netflix. It's definitely well worth watching. It's about four series, and it gets a nice conclusion as well. But they're not like Time Machine sending them physically back. It sends their minds back into the body of someone who was about to die. And they kind of then have to take over their life and how they then operate as a kind of a cell to these complete random strangers who are now suddenly working together when you don't really know, like from the outside, you don't really know why. Inside, you obviously know that they're a team from the future and what they get up to. And then of course it goes horribly wrong and they, obviously it does. But yeah, that's something I was kind of thinking like how, that's another one of those, how would I run this? What would I do with that?
Yeah. Kind of like it smells a little bit like a Quantum Leap type concept, right? But it's funny, my mind works the same way, Stu. Like when I hear something like that, I'm like, ooh, what would I run that in?
Yeah. what bits do I need for that? What system would that be in? Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, Stu, there's a lot of things to do on a Saturday afternoon that doesn't involve spending 45 minutes with me talking about games. So I do appreciate you making the time.
No, it's not a problem. It's a lot of fun. It's good.
And for those of you listening, this is the end. You made it the whole way. I appreciate you doing that too. Take care. Thanks a ton for tuning in to another fantastic episode of Tabletop Talk.
A big shout out to Stu for joining me today. You can find out more about his work on StuGoff.com. What game from your childhood do you wish you could play again? I'm dying to hear your thoughts. Let me know on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, or drop me a line at admin@thirdfloorwars.com. And don't worry, all these links are in the show notes. Could you do me a solid and hit the subscribe button, or maybe even leave a rating? Are one of your pals into this type of thing? Would they dig this episode too? How about you share it? You don't want to miss the next episode. I sit down with Guy Milner of the Unconventional GM's YouTube channel. Happy gaming, friends. Hey, you know that thing you've been thinking about? The idea that's been churning around in your brain space? Today's probably a good day to make it. Why don't you go create? Oh, that's cool. Well, you know, it's funny. I didn't think of it in relation to Westworld, but now it helps me kind of orient it a lot better.
See, I thought that was, I didn't think I was hiding my tracks there at all. I thought that was like,
well, you got to remember that I'm not a smart person, Stu. So. You probably weren't. All right, I'll put this back. Hey, are you still here? Wow. Well, the episode is over, but if you're bored, why not go to patreon.com and support the show for as little as $1 a month? Yeah, you can just scroll down and get the link. It's Patreon that makes this and all of our other content possible. Don't you want to join the other floorheads on the Patreon Discord? Anyway, thanks for sticking around. Take care.